And this is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Thanks for tuning in today. Will your car ever be able to drive itself? There are a lot of companies betting it will. Google, Tesla, even General Motors are among those investing in autonomous or self-driving cars. The upside, a driver who's never distracted, never sleepy, and never drunk. The downside, complicated technology where one mistake could mean the difference between life and death. A self-driving car being tested by Uber struck and killed a pedestrian in Arizona on Sunday, raising new questions about the technology. If and when they do arrive, driverless cars are also likely to change more than just the way we get around. After all, if cars drive themselves, do we still need mass transit, parking lots, or garages? What happens to our cities and our homes? We're going to spend the hour talking about self-driving cars and what they might mean for the future of transportation and for society. Three guests join me this hour. Charlie Zelli is the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Frank Duma is director of the State and Local Policy Program at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. And Mary Smith is a senior vice president at the firm Walker Consultants. She plans and designs parking projects throughout the world. She joins us on the phone from Indiana. You can call in with your question, too. The number is 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Thanks all for being here.
Thanks, Mike.
Charlie Zelli, let me start with you. Is this a question of when these self-driving cars come in or if they come in?
Well, there's no question the technology has been evolving for some years, and it continues to. So when we think about the bold future, a lot of the automation that is coming to vehicles is in vehicles now. We think about lane-changing warnings, backup cameras, some of the super cruise where you can lock in the car in front of you and it'll control your speed. So it's going to continue to develop whether we're prepared or not. It's happening.
Frank Duma, do you think we're far away from widespread use of these cars?
I agree that it is developing. We probably will see it before we think we're ready for it. That's kind of the fun aspect from being on the policy side where I work, is that we are starting to explore these questions now. And opportunities to see things in the vehicles we're driving, but then also the vehicles that are being tested on the ground right now, you think that that only could be on paper, and then you're stepping into it the next day.
Wow. Mary Smith, what about you? How far away do you think we are from widespread use of these self-driving cars?
Well, from everything we've studied and we've tried to watch carefully at almost everything that's said, it looks like there'll be some commercial ride-hailing or services starting maybe as soon as 2018 or 2019, in which it's no longer a test. Waymo has moved their driver in the test they're doing in Phoenix. They've moved that driver to the back seat, so it's not even at the steering wheel anymore. And GM says they're going to start a commercial service next year where you can just call up and get a ride. We don't see that the technology is going to get far enough for personal vehicles to become fully autonomous, what they call level 5. Maybe until 2025, 2027, 2030, somewhere in there before you can go out and buy a fully autonomous car. But you will see in limited areas where it's already been mapped and they understand exactly where they're going, what they call L4, level 4 shuttles and ride-hailing, as soon as 2020.
What about this accident in Arizona over the weekend? A pedestrian was hit by a self-driving Uber car. Does that change the calculation, Charlie Zelli?
Well, it was really an unfortunate accident, and I think Uber did the right thing by suspending those self-driving pilot programs until we could determine what was the cause and what happened. But, you know, this technology is evolving, the safety is evolving, and when you consider the some 40,000 casualties we have every year on highways in this country, you know, not every accident has the level of scrutiny that this one will have. And so I think some states have been pretty open about it. We're not yet in Minnesota, but I think we'll know a lot more.
40,000 traffic deaths.
Yes.
All involving human drivers.
And many of them pedestrians. In the state of Minnesota, we had approximately 400 deaths last year. That's down from a number of years ago where it was over 1,000. And we've been able to use some engineering and education and enforcement to reduce that. But 400 is still not acceptable. And we think actually the autonomous and the technology coming to cars and how it connects to infrastructure will be the next frontier of safety.
Well, and that was my next question. And I'll ask Mary Smith from Indianapolis. Is the main attraction of these self-driving cars just that they would make driving safer?
Absolutely. That's the number one reason I think that the governmental folks are on board is totally safety. But I think there's a lot of other benefits. For example, the disabled, the elderly will be able to get much better mobility than they have today. You'll see people be able to improve their productivity. Instead of having to commute for an hour, they can work on that hour or enjoy a movie or many other things that make their lives a little less stressful. So there's the cost of many things will come down, including the things that have drivers. Some of the deliveries, some of those things will come down because you won't have humans at such an extent in the middle of the trip. So there's a lot of benefits. There's a lot of impediments, too, but there's a lot of benefits that will come in addition to safety.
And, of course, the problem now seems like people are enjoying movies as they're driving.
That's correct.
That's wrong.
Yes. They should not do that.
It'll be a lot better if they can actually have the car drive itself and then they watch the movie.
Absolutely.
It seems in some ways people are making the decision already that they want to have a self-driving vehicle because they are being so attracted to do other tasks than drive.
Right. A lot of distracted driving. That's Frank Duma. He is from the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School. Charlie Zelli is here. He's the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And on the phone with us is Mary Smith. She's a senior vice president at Walker Consultants. We're talking about self-driving cars. Are we ready for them? It doesn't seem like it really matters. It seems like they're on the way. Give us a call with your question, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000 is the number. And Frank Duma, how do these things actually work? They have sensors and computers and maps and cameras. Give me the
sure.
Self-driving car for dummies.
Well, I can't give you a much more than that, but I can certainly tell you the types of technology that are being involved. Probably the one that has been most important is the development of something called LIDAR, which is like a radar, but it uses light to bounce back and create really a 3D image of the surroundings of the vehicle. And that allows it to really understand what's happening. And then that information is processed by a computer. It can teach the vehicle how to react to various things. This is supplemented by radar as well as video cameras, and then all supported by high-powered computers that are able to process that information. And this is really kind of an artificial intelligence to be able to understand things like object permanence, that if something is there and then it disappears behind another object, to expect it to come out on the other side. Mm-hmm. And these should work in a redundant manner so that if one does not do what it's supposed to, another is able to still keep the car moving in the way that it's supposed to and as safe as possible.
And Charlie Zelli, I know MnDOT has been looking at this, and you had a self-driving bus you were testing. What have you found out so far? What have you learned from that?
Well, we actually have an advantage in Minnesota because we're a cold weather environment. And so we want to be one of the states on the leading edge of both development and policy considerations of autonomous vehicles. You know, the Easy Mile bus, we call it mini, small bus. We had it up at our MinRoad testing facility in Albertville. And, you know, when you have snow on the ground and snow actually falling, that's a different environment than Arizona, California, where some of these vehicles have been tested. And even on the first day, the little mini was going down its route and stopped abruptly because a snowflake was coming down a few feet ahead of it. So this is something the software engineers were able to adjust and consider. So we appreciate that we're part of the testing protocol and as well as develop a greater community interest in what this could serve in the future.
Let's take a caller. Bob is on the line from St. Paul.
Hey, thank you. Mm-hmm. What about self-driving trucks? I mean, clearly in terms of their mass, they would be a lot safer once we get people away from being the drivers. But also, it's one of the last places where we have hundreds of thousands of actual people doing the work. So what about, you know, the massive job displacement that comes from that?
Frank Duma?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that trucks are a big opportunity. One thing, or a couple of statistics that I pay attention to is one that truck driving is the most common job in the United States right now, and two, we have a shortage of truck drivers. So there's an opportunity to supplement what's there with self-driving technology. Be able to merge things together, at least in the short term. Right now, there are tests of self-driving trucks going across Arizona. They've got a person there monitoring, but the technology is being employed on over the road. Then once they get into the urban areas, the human takes over.
Why is Arizona so popular to test these things?
Arizona has kind of put its name out there as a place that they're not going to try to overly regulate. California is where the technology was really born. California has been much more strict in its regulations, so Arizona more or less responded to that by having a similar climate, but also then stating that they're more open to seeing private industry try to develop this.
Charlie Zelli, do self-driving trucks, is that an opportunity or is that a concern for you?
I think it's all an opportunity. Certainly, there's a role for drivers even when there's autonomous driving, as Frank has pointed out. And, you know, I have a career in the bus business. Our bus operators, we call them, not drivers, do a lot more than just operate the vehicle. They're the concierge, they're safety officer, they handle baggage, they handle maintenance, they're navigating. So I could foresee a time when you have a job change, and just like pilots in an airplane, you could have a lot of great features that help safety and help guide a bus or a truck. And so I think that we'll see how it evolves.
Well, let's take another caller, Bruno on the line from Mankato.
Yes, listen, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a question. You know, I'm 78, so, you know, I've learned to change with all this technology. But since you're talking about perhaps 100% automatic driving vehicles, will I necessarily have to carry automobile insurance? Because if there is an accident and I'm not driving, maybe I've fallen asleep in the passenger seat or decided to get a call in the back of my truck, why should I be liable? And the other thing, how would it affect even truck drivers? You know, if the guy is sleeping in the back and that truck winds up in an accident, will he be liable for it because he wasn't sitting there as a backup?
Well, that's a great question. Charlie Zelli.
You know, I think that insurance rates ultimately will go down, and maybe even insurance underwriters may help be the driving force with more autonomy, because as there are fewer crashes, there will be fewer costs to spread among all the different operators. So I actually think that one of the benefits of the whole autonomous driving will be fewer crashes, fewer deaths, fewer costs, and so I don't think it's an issue of who's at fault. The issue is the overall market will become better.
Mary Smith, how about you? Let's get you to weigh in on that.
Yeah, we're hearing that it's more than likely that the auto manufacturers or the people who were designing the autonomous cars, at least in the early years, will wrap the insurance in either the purchase cost. Or, for example, the ride-hailing companies like Uber and Lyft will carry the insurance, and therefore, when you buy a car that is autonomous, the insurance will be covered by the manufacturer because it will become a manufacturer's liability issue. Again, we all agree with Charlie that it's that the overall cost is going to be lower, but it's probably not going to be an issue for the individual with the insurance. It'll probably be covered by the manufacturers, at least in the early years.
Frank, do you see it that way too?
Yeah, I think so. I'll go back to something that Mary mentioned earlier, talking about level 4, level 5. There are different levels of autonomy here, and the caller kind of mentioned two different aspects that we need to pay attention to. One, if we're at that level 4 or level 5, the vehicle will be expected to handle all safe operations. And in that case, we would expect to see it to be this a charge that's wrapped up and paid by the manufacturer or something like that. Lower than that, we still have this expectation that the human is going to be the backup. So if you're in something that's lower than a level, if you're in a level 1, 2, or 3 type of vehicles, you're not supposed to crawl into the back seat. You still will have that liability.
But at least we mentioned earlier Waymo, which I think is the Google company. I was watching some of their videos, and the people are sitting in back, and the steering wheel is moving by itself. It kind of freaked me out, to be honest with you.
And Waymo is moving to that level 4 situation, which is that there are certain areas in which they'll operate where the vehicle will be expected to handle any sort of situation where something goes wrong.
Can I add that,
yes,
for
please.
The truckers, one of the really cool ideas I've seen is, and I've seen it, somebody did it as a animation, but the portion of the trip that really works well, quickly, autonomous, is the interstate. And there'll be transfer stations right off the interstate, and the vehicle will drive from transfer station to transfer station, and then a driver will come and pick up that vehicle and take it to the destination in town and help unload it, and then get it reloaded wherever he has to get it reloaded, and then take it back to the transfer station, and then from there the vehicle will go out on its own and go back on the interstate to the next city. So there's still going to be jobs. They won't be the overnight stressful, far away from your family jobs, but there'll still be a lot of jobs related to that. There'll be people who will be online watching the trucks and handling a problem. If it gets befuddled and it has to pull to the side of the road, they'll get online and figure out what the problem is and get it moving again. So California, in fact, is requiring operators to run driverless in California. So you have to have somebody online ready to help the vehicle if there's a problem.
Charlie Zelli?
Well, one aspect that following up on what Mary was saying is the idea of connection. You know, this isn't just about autonomous vehicles. It's about autonomous and connected vehicles. They're connected to each other. They're connected to the infrastructure, and they're connected sometimes to the home office. And, you know, as a representative of the owner of the road, you know, we're actually looking at how we put in signals, how we manage and platoon traffic, how we're thinking about getting greater efficiency out of the system that we have. So as this was developing as kind of autonomous vehicles by themselves, it is now much more about how do we manage the entire system? And that includes not for just for a passenger who might go from a bus to a car to a bike and have that seamless trip actually be planned ahead of time, but for that freight box that Mary was referring to. It goes from the truck to a transloading place to another vehicle. And so this is now about the future of mobility, not just about the actual cars.
And it's about integrating all those aspects.
That's right.
So whose responsibility is that? Is that yours as a commissioner of transportation? Is that the manufacturers of these vehicles? Is it the taxpayers, the drivers?
You know, that's a very ongoing conversation that's happening now. And I know that state DOTs, and we're at the table with the U.S. Department of Transportation, actually planning and talking about that with policy think tanks, with local governments, with the auto manufacturers. And that is in part why the governor issued an executive order a couple of weeks ago establishing an advisory committee with many stakeholders to be thoughtful about putting together a strategy for what makes most sense in Minnesota.
Talking about autonomous vehicles, otherwise known as self-driving cars, with Charlie Zelli, who's the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation, Frank Duma from the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School, and Mary Smith from Walker Consultants. A lot of folks on the line. Let's take another call. Lee in Battle Lake.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am an over-the-road truck driver. I'm a 30-year veteran as an over-the-road truck driver. I've got many millions of miles under my belt. There's a couple of things I want to point out to you. Number one, autonomous vehicles are, as far as fully autonomous vehicles, are way in the future, and I'll tell you why. Number one, commercial airlines have had autonomy. Their jets have been able to take off and land all by themselves for many, many years now. But they always put a pilot behind in the seat. They always have a co-pilot in the seat. Another thing, these vehicles, they run off of sensors. Keep in mind, all autonomy vehicles run off of sensors. What's the first thing to fail in every vehicle? What's the first thing to turn on a check engine light in any vehicle? Sensors. They go bad all the time, especially in bad weather. In perfect weather, maybe you'll have some of these autonomy vehicles running. But in these bad weather conditions, they're going to fail all the time, and they're going to end up killing someone. And the last thing you want is a 40-ton, 80,000-pound vehicle being autonomously driven, sharing the road with other vehicles. That's a scary thought.
Okay, let's get some reaction to that. Frank Duma, let's start with you.
Well, I think the caller hits upon some very important points, one of which is that we need to understand and test these vehicles in a number of fairly harsh environments to understand what they can withstand and when they're not going to be safe to operate. The other aspect of that is that maintenance will continue to be an issue. And so that's one reason why we tend to see that these are going to be deployed in fleets first, so that you can maintain, just like airplanes, a highest level of good repair, so that you're not watching these sensors go without people being ready for it.
Mary Smith, do you want to weigh in on that one?
Well, I think Frank's absolutely correct, and it will be in fleets first, whether it's fleet trucking or whether it's the fleets of cars serving ride-hailing. And there's going to be a lot of maintenance there. The ride-hailing folks are talking to the rental car companies in order to handle their maintenance, because they can scale up. And they're also getting hurt by the autonomous vehicles, but they're going to try to use their facilities that maybe aren't going to be needed as much to maintain the vehicles, and they can scale up and properly maintain the autonomous vehicles.
Charlie Zelli, what do you think? Trucks might be the hardest thing to do here?
Well, I actually think we'll see more technology applied to freight simply because I think there's a true business imperative to drive efficiency. But I think the driver, the caller made a great point that over his 30 years, he's seen a lot, and he's probably seen a lot of technology improvements. We're not going to leap to level 5 in a couple of years, but I think we'll be at level 4. And as we test these trucks in controlled environments, we'll be able to ensure that safety is paramount. You know, I met with railroads yesterday. They have positive train control being employed. The default position of positive train control is that the train stops. So I could see that if there's something wrong, a sensor stops, the truck won't just barrel off into the ditch. I think it might safely be able to stop itself. So I think there's a lot of kind of fail-safe systems that will have to be deployed.
Charlie Zelli is here. He's the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Frank Duma is director of the State and Local Policy Program at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School. And Mary Smith is on the line from Indianapolis. She's a senior vice president at the firm Walker Consultants. And if you have a question, you can join us. 651-227-6000 is the number. 651-227-6000. And Seema is on the line from Minneapolis. Let's go right to Seema on the phone.
Hello, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a comment. I had recently purchased a Honda Odyssey 2018, and it has sensors all around. And one day I was driving in the winter, and then the sensor was blocked by the ice, and it kept saying, I'm approaching object, though there was nothing in the front. I was driving on the freeway. I was driving on the feeder, the street, local street, and there was nothing on the front. And, you know, I think this is a false security for the people. They think, like, they're going to have autonomous vehicles or this and that. I think it's a very bad idea because, I mean, you know, what's going to happen to the car when their sensors are blocked by the ice or by the debris or by garbage or whatever, then how is it going to drive?
All right. Great question. And Charlie Zelli, you mentioned it a little bit earlier.
We actually are doing this cold weather testing for that reason. Much of those sensors, which might be a little camera or a little sonar thing, you know, frankly, it's important to have multiple sensors. And I think that that's part of the development of the autonomous automated vehicles. I think Frank mentioned LIDAR and radar and cameras. So a lot of these are backup systems. So as the technology evolves, we aren't depending on just one.
It does raise a question, though, because it seems like you're using some pretty sophisticated technology. And how long would a car last? I mean, you don't have a computer that's 10 years old or 15 years old. Frank, what about that? Would you have to keep upgrading these cars?
Well, that's another reason why we go back and we keep coming back to the idea that we see that these being deployed in fleets first, because there probably will be some higher capital cost per person. But if you share those costs among a number of people, it becomes more affordable. And that allows you to rotate that fleet through more quickly than we might own our own car, so that you can continue to have these upgrades. Also, our computer box may not be 10 years old, but it's probably restored itself several times over the time that we've owned it because it's been updated over the air. And we anticipate that probably would be applied to these vehicles as well, so that they will continue to improve even as they're being used.
Mary Smith, if this does come to pass, will people own individual cars anymore, or will it all just be self-driving Ubers or Lyfts or something else that people use?
Well, there's a lot of folks that are projecting a tremendous use of ride hailing and resulting in up to a 90% reduction in the use of private cars. We don't see that happening, among other things. About 20% of the U.S. population lives in rural areas, and about 30% of the miles traveled are by people who live in rural areas, then ride hailing isn't really going to be very practical there. They may have autonomous cars. They may send it home after that, takes them to work and send it home and have it come back and pick them up, but they won't use a ride hailing service to do that. We've done a lot of study and looked at a lot of different projections, and we really think that there's probably going to be about an overall nationwide 40% reduction in parking. But that'll be for an office building. The average office building in the United States would have a 40% reduction of parking because people are using ride hailing to get to it. A lot more if it's in downtown Minneapolis, a lot less if it's out in western Minnesota. And in addition to that, it will be happen over a very long period of time that this transition will occur. There's 260 million cars on the road today, and probably another 150 million sold before we get to level 5, which, as everybody's been discussing, snow is a problem. There's a lot of problems to be solved for level 5, and so it's going to take 20 years to get all the current cars off the road, and so it's going to happen very slowly over a long period of time. But we think that the ultimate impact is about 40%. When you put population growth in that, if Minneapolis and St. Paul grow with the national population, the parking demand will increase maybe through 2030, and then by 2050 come back down to about where it is today, the number of spaces required in a real number.
All right. Well, let's take another caller, Peter in St. Paul.
Yeah, you guys had touched on the implications for people with disabilities, but, you know, as a advocate and then as someone who's actually into cars, I haven't seen much promise in that regard. There haven't been services from Lyft or Uber, there haven't been prototypes that can service someone who needs to use a wheelchair. And I wonder if you guys could touch on any things you have heard about that in that space.
Charlie Zelli.
Well, I think it's a really important opportunity and service opportunity for disabilities, people with disabilities. I know I have talked to Uber, and they are very interested in getting into that market. Certainly one of the benefits of the autonomous bus we've been testing is, and a lot of the attention has come from the disability community. And so I think that we may not be seeing it every day now, but I think we'll be seeing service soon.
And what's the advantage to an autonomous vehicle when it comes to that kind of service?
Well, I think it offers, obviously, freedom and mobility when it is difficult to operate a vehicle itself. And plus, there's this, like, Easy Mile bus that we have has special ramp features. It has space for those in a chair. It has coded sounds for sensory deprived folks. So it's, I think there's opportunity for extending service for those who have been, frankly, marginalized. And that's true for whether you're marginalized from a standpoint of ability, but also physical ability and also economic ability. I think there's we haven't really talked about the equity components of the future of this connected world, but we'll be able to manage the shared services of transit and shared vehicles to provide access for people to jobs for health reasons.
Well, let's get into some of that. What would this kind of world mean for transit? Would there still be buses? Would there still be light rail trains? Or could you just hail a self-driving car to come by wherever you are?
I keep going back to the idea this is a network and a system, and I think there are those who fantasize we don't have transit, but the reality is transit is a kind of a backbone of high density movements. The idea of passengers, single passenger cars running around is just simply we don't have the capacity for that. So if you can have better connections with and different and evolving kinds of transit, certainly there would be light rail spines because they're very high capacity, but from those you could have amazing different options of transit or a shared vehicle.
And Frank Duma, would this mean more or less roads, do you think? How would this make the transportation system look?
Well, I think we'll continue to have roads to wherever people happen to be and where they want to go. We've got an issue of the need for the vehicles to map and understand where they're at. So probably just like cell phones, there will be final places that that technology reaches much later than higher density areas or higher use roads. But it's something that I think that we'll see it gradually build out. And I want to go back to the transit point here, that if you think about transit as getting people from point A to point B, you definitely have a density issue and you need higher capacity and higher density areas like around light rail lines. But then also you think about rural areas where you can have people with disabilities. You can have people who are no longer able to drive. And if you can bring transit to their door at a lower cost and at greater hours than is currently available in rural transit, you have made a real contribution to their quality of life.
And you can do that with an autonomous vehicle.
That's right. That's the vision that we're hearing, at least.
All right, let's take another caller. Colleen in Minneapolis.
Yes, I was wondering, and I don't know if this is too sci-fi and just a good book for someone to take the idea, but what about hacking? Look at the problems we have in our most secure credit, et cetera. Why not hack a car, either just to cause havoc or a terrorist event or even for kidnapping?
Wow, good question. Mary Smith, what about that?
Well, it's definitely one of the issues that is being explored. I don't see it being talked about too much in the public sector, but I know it's really seriously being considered by the designers that are working on these vehicles because they know that's an issue. It's kind of not my area to be able to talk about what all they can do to minimize the risk, but there certainly is going to be a risk there.
Hmm. Frank Duma, what do you think?
Yeah, and it's a concern, and I can say it's a concern because it's a concern right now. Our vehicles can be hacked and taken over. I hate to scare everybody right now, but that's the way it is. There was a fairly well-publicized Wired article a couple of years ago about someone in a Jeep Cherokee that willingly allowed hackers to take over his vehicle to show how easily it could be done. This is something that's going to be a continual issue. One thing that I see that could be an advantage is that as we get to vehicles that are more autonomous or automated, they, when something goes wrong, they may be able to more quickly recognize something is wrong and know how to pull themselves safely to the side and notify some authority that there's some nefarious action going on instead of us being sort of out on an island in our own vehicle right now.
Charlie Zelli, is this something you're thinking about at the state level? I mean, I drive a 2002 VW. I don't think anybody could hack that. It might rust out before it gets hacked.
We are definitely thinking about it, and not just the cybersecurity issues of the vehicle itself, but again, I'm back to the system. And as we think about our traffic management cameras and our signals, that is now evolving to where we'll have a lot of big data about platoons of cars maybe getting through traffic easier in rush hour. And that'll involve not just data, but some of the bandwidth of that the FCC is now looking at in terms of who controls what and who owns what data and how secure can we make it. So I think this is very much a real-time conversation. You know, we're piloting some signals that will be very much connected to vehicles on Highway 55, 394, and Highway 7 as kind of a pilot program. And we're doing that this year. And one of the concerns we want to make sure is that we don't want our signals hacked. So you know, it's I think it's, as Frank mentioned, it's in kind of every area of society now.
But this whole networking and data, and it really does open a lot of possibilities for how the system would work.
Absolutely, I think that could make the system more efficient. We are expecting 800,000 more people into the metro area. We're not going to be building more general lanes. You know, sorry, folks, that's just so costly. But maybe we can make the lanes we have more efficient. I think that's the idea behind MinPass lanes, driving more density, and maybe there's autonomous features that could help with that.
Betty is on the line in St. Paul. Betty, go ahead.
Hi. Yes. I appreciate the fact that you think that this will make some transit much more affordable. I don't think it will. I think it'll be more expensive, particularly people won't be able that are in the lower incomes won't be able to afford their own autonomous vehicle, whereas the upper echelon can always buy whatever they want. They can buy something, send it, as you said, drive them themselves to work, send it home. They don't have to pay for parking. So people that can't afford that still have to pay for parking if they have, you know, the same job. It'll be harder to compete for jobs for the lower echelon, because when the upper echelon have more convenience and faster and cheaper ways they get to work, well, then they stop supporting transit. They stop supporting metro mobility and all of that. And that just widens the gap for the income spectrum.
All right, let's have Charlie Zelli react.
I appreciate you asking that question, and I think it's a very important policy issue that we should be talking about now. In fact, I think that's one of the reasons behind the governor putting an executive order, getting an advisory committee with different stakeholders, because the affordability of access to your jobs, to getting to school, getting health care, an equity component and just an everyday component is really, really key. And so the question is for employers who want to attract and retain a workforce, they are very interested in this idea that there's a way for employees affordably to find their way to a job. And so this is not just for the haves and the have-nots. I think the idea of affordability of transportation is key for everybody.
If there's a fleet service out there that could drive you to work and back, Would that be more expensive than owning your own car or less? Frank, what do you think?
It could be less and more likely would be less. The difference is that right now we pay a lot of our costs in the purchase of the vehicle. You instead change those costs to your the trip. And that helps you think about how you can make your trips more efficiently. It also opens up the opportunity for a policy question of how can you maybe target those that are not able to afford their full trips, that they get direct subsidies rather than an indirect subsidy that we currently have to work with.
Let's take a call from Sean in Minneapolis.
Hello. Good to talk to you, Frank and Charlie and Mary. My question has to do with how we can help cities be ready to make the most of the fleets of autonomous electric vehicles through local policymaking, and I'm helping to create a Resilient Cities Coalition here with the Alliance for Sustainability, and I know cities are really excited about having less room used for parking, so they would want to encourage fleets of vehicles instead of individually owned vehicles, and then also looking at equity and access and how to pay for your local roads. So maybe you could see if the Governor's Task Force can help cities get ready to start making rules. One of the issues is that there is a preemption bill in the legislature that would prevent cities individually from regulating Uber and Lyft. Okay. So we'd love to hear your thoughts and help cities be ready for this opportunity.
Frank Duma, let's go to you.
Yeah, I think that's something that the task force can look at. This is clearly a policy opportunity here. What can cities do? Can they reduce their parking regulations? Can they try to create incentives for electric vehicles to increase sharing? How do they work with Uber, Lyft, even bike sharing? These are all questions that should be talked about right now.
And Mary Smith, how could this make our cities look different in the future?
Well, certainly there's going to be a reduction in the space required for parking, particularly in the densest areas. Even if you only have a 50%, let's just say, reduction in parking, that's a huge amount of space in the United States that's used for parking. There's a general rule that there's 4 parking spaces for every car in the United States. So if the car can go back home and stay in the residence, that's 3 less. If it's, you can give up the car because you can take shared rides to wherever you need to go and maybe use a zip car when you have to go farther away. So there's lots of opportunities and there's going to be lots of choices for people. Generally, they're saying that the every study we've seen says that the cost of taking a ride in an autonomous ride-hailing vehicle will be 30 to 50% of what it is to take that same ride in your own car. So there is an opportunity to reduce the cost for people. But one of the things that may have a huge impact is once you're in the car and not driving, they're talking about the information, the ability to give you information to sell you movies to watch while you're in the car, to let you watch a cable news and pay a subscription for that. They're saying that the opportunity to provide information to people in their vehicles is a huge one. Mm-hmm. There's one paper I saw that talked about having the concierge on the bus not be a driver but be a Starbucks barista providing your Starbucks right on the bus.
Charlie Zelli, let me give you a last word here.
Well, I appreciate the caller's, Sean's work with smart cities, you know, and I think we're benefiting from the forward-looking cities we have here in Minnesota who look at transportation not as the end but as the means toward it, improving our prosperity and our livability. And I think we're learning from other states and other cities that some of the benefits will be like in Columbus, Ohio, which won a Smart Cities Award, and one of the key metrics was infant mortality in a certain neighborhood. So we have to think more broadly about how all this becomes a way to improve our lives, and that's why we have to be smart about what do we want in Minnesota And that's what our task is ahead of us.
Well, we are going to wrap it up there to get to some breaking news. Thank you so much for being here. Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation, Mary Smith, Senior Vice President at Walker Consultants, and Frank Duma from the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Thanks, everybody who called, too. Really interesting program.